Namat tu ratanatayasa. Welcome everyone again. And today I will be talking about meditation, specifically, I hope, how to meditate. And hopefully getting in, if we have time, to some of the benefits or the results that come from meditation. So when I talk about how to meditate, of course, right away it's going to be at the top of everyone's mind that this is probably simply going to be how to practice one type of meditation. And that's generally how I teach when I do my videos on how to meditate. I'm actually being a little bit deceptive because I'm not teaching all kinds of meditation. When I teach meditation, I generally teach one specific type of meditation. But the great thing about today's talk is I won't be doing that. I will be teaching you how to meditate in a very broad sense. It still probably won't cover anywhere near all of the types of meditation that exist out there, but it should give a sort of a good cross-section of some of the different types of meditation. And the idea is to sort of help to give an understanding of where certain meditations differ, and as a result, where the results of those meditations will differ. That it's not really proper for us to say that all meditations or all practices or all paths lead in the same direction. Probably I'll be giving a talk next week about the different paths, but that's more of a Buddhist, general Buddhist talk. When we're talking about meditation, even specifically focusing on meditation, not all meditations lead in the same direction, or not all meditations lead to the same result. They can all be useful for the ultimate goal, which is enlightenment, but in and of themselves, they often have very specific goals, and the results are thus varied. And I'll be explaining how that is. In the tradition that I follow, we like to separate meditation into two distinct parts, and I'm going to try to explain why that is and how we go about doing that, how we can possibly differentiate between different types of meditation. The way that we differentiate, the classification that we use to differentiate between these two different types of meditation, is whether the object of the meditation is an ultimate reality or it's a concept. Meaning, is it something that is really being experienced, or is it a creation, extrapolation that we have given to a certain experience? For instance, seeing is obviously an experience, and that's something that we could, in one sense, say is ultimately real. But seeing an object, for instance, taking the Buddha as our meditation object, as soon as we apply a judgment to it, saying this is the Buddha, or that is a monk, or a cat, or a horse, or so on, then we are employing a state of mind which has extrapolated on the experience. So instead of simply seeing and knowing it as an experience of seeing, we're then focusing on something that is not part of the reality of the experience. So whereas there are certain understandings that can come about simply by watching the phenomenon of seeing, because we can see that seeing comes and goes, arises and ceases. When you open your eyes, you see this character of mind sitting there. When you close your eyes or when you look away, you cease to see. Or when you focus on something else, you cease to see. The seeing disappears. But if you're focusing on the character and saying that's Yuttadhamma, or that's this monk, or that's the teacher, then you start to get the feeling that it's always there. And so you can't gain this understanding of what we call impermanence. It can't come about from something which is conceptual, because in your mind, I'm always sitting here. There's always this character sitting there. In reality, we know this isn't true, but unless we're focused on reality, we lose sight of that, and we're not able to develop insight. So we separate meditation into two categories, one being based on a concept, one being based on ultimate reality. And I'm going to go through those types of meditation which are based on a concept, which are very Buddhist, even in the tradition that I follow, and I think in all traditions, and are practiced throughout the Buddhist world. But with the qualification that I think in the tradition that I follow, probably several other traditions, these meditations are not going to lead in and of themselves to enlightenment, because, as I said, they're not focused on reality. There's 40 of them. These are 40 examples of meditation subjects. Now, it should be fairly obvious as you start to think about it that a conceptual meditation, there could be an infinite number of meditations based on a concept. So we can only understand these as examples, but as pretty good examples and as sort of representative of some of the best ways to use a concept in your benefit to develop wholesome states of mind. Sometimes because of the wholesome nature of the object, for instance, in the case of thinking of the Buddha, sometimes simply in the purity and the very simplicity of the object, in the case of the color, focusing on a color. So I'm going to go through the 40 of these and give you a brief overview of some of the meditations out there and how to practice them. The first 10 of the 40 are 10 totalities, they're called. And the idea of totality is giving this your total attention, or making this specific concept your universe, so that it's all that exists in your mind, it's all that there is. And these are the ones that are very simple, they're a very pure conceptual object, something which the mind can easily focus on and easily fix and become absorbed in. And these are the four elements, so focusing on, say, something which represents the earth element, focusing on a bowl of water, focusing on a fire, a flame, focusing on the air, or in this case the wind, when you focus on wind blowing through the trees. These four are considered very basic Buddhist meditation, something which you hear about in all the various traditions. I know of a monk who practiced with a teacher who taught him the fire kasina, and I was living with him for a while, and he was telling me about his experiences, and I think he didn't have great success. In the end, he got these burning sensations in his feet that he couldn't get rid of because of focusing on the fire. It can actually be quite potent. There are stories of people who develop the fire kasina, and as a result they're able to shoot flame or to heat up. You hear these stories, I don't know if they're true, of monks sitting in the snow and they're able to melt away the snow and the ice around them for a certain distance. And I have no reason to doubt this. This is based on the power of the mind, which comes about through intense superhuman states of concentration, which most of us have no clue about or have never had any encounter with. So what you would do in these cases, and actually what you're going to see as I go through these, is that in all cases what we're talking about is mantra meditation. And in this tradition, what is really interesting, something that I think has been lost in modern Buddhist circles, is this idea of using a mantra, which was of course very current in the time of the Buddha and in Buddhist circles throughout the ages. So in the case of the earth kasina, you would focus on, say, a disc of earth, and you'd try to get this nice red clay, something that just looked purely earth with no blemishes and no distinct parts that would take away your attention, just something that looked to you like earth, not too big and not too small, and then you'd stare at it. And you'd say to yourself, earth, 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 over and over again. Or in Pali they would have this word, patavi, 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 which simply means earth. In Thai they say din, 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 which means earth. And you would focus on that until you could close your eyes and still see the disc. So that when you closed your eyes, it didn't matter that you couldn't see it anymore. It was still there in your mind's eye. And this is what we hear about what we call the third eye. It's this place in your forehead, just above your two eyes, you know, where we understand the third eye to be, well, you focus on that spot as seeing the earth element. And as you see the earth clearer and clearer, eventually you don't need the disc at all. You can go back into your kuti, into your room, close the door, and sit down and just focus on the image which exists in your mind. And this can take days or weeks or months or even years. And once you're able to do that, your mind will become fixed and focused, and you'll enter into this higher stages of absorption, which will then lead to, you know, various supernormal states, which I'm going to go into as sort of the benefit of these meditations, what good comes from them. But to understand how it is that we practice meditation, what we're talking about is using a word which represents or reminds us of the object. And this is what we call sati, or mindfulness, or smriti in Sanskrit. The meaning of sati, sarati, is the verb from sarata, to remember. The root is sar, which means to remember or to recollect or to remind oneself. So when we focus on the earth totality, the taking earth as our entirety, as our universe, then we have this word which reminds us, which brings us back and allows us to focus on it. The same with fire. If you've ever seen those cartoons with the guy going fire, 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 you sort of get the idea. But I mean, there's a great happiness and peace that even comes just from doing it, like as a juvenile. When you take it up as a meditation, all you have, it's actually just that. You focus on the fire and you say fire, 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 and your mind becomes focused and tranquil. You can do this with a candle flame. You just look at the candle flame, saying to yourself fire, 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 getting the idea of fire in your mind, not focusing on any one of the parts of it, but just as it as fire, until it becomes clear in the mind and you're able to do away with the actual object. The earth, air, water, and fire. The rest of them are the color kasina, which is the blue, the yellow, the red, and the white. And these are, as you can see, those are the primary colors. The blue, yellow, and red are the primary colors, and then white is just another very pure color. You could pick, of course, any color, but considering these are primary, they become very easy for the mind to become focused on, to fix on. And in the same way, you would say to yourself white, 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 or blue, 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 and just focusing on it until it became so clear in your mind's eye that it became the whole of your universe. And that would allow you to get to greater states of concentration and even to magical powers of various sorts. It's interesting, most people probably don't even believe in the existence of magical powers, and if you've never done any of these, you probably never will have a chance to experience some magical state of being. But it's funny how when you do practice them, it actually does take you to very interesting and surprising results, which I'll be talking about later a little bit. And then we have just a few others. There is the light kasina and the space kasina. So the light kasina is focusing on a light, maybe through a keyhole or focusing on the light coming through the window or so on. And space kasina, focusing on empty space. These ones are considered pretty easy for just about anyone to practice. They're often given as a general basic meditation practice in Buddhist countries, because even young children can take these up. But when I've taught meditation to children, I often start with something simple like this, sort of even simpler, or not necessarily simpler, but more familiar to them. What I've experimented with is having them focus on a cat. So have them close their eyes and imagine a cat in their minds, and just say to themselves over and over again, cat, cat, cat. Now, it's just a means of focusing the mind and keeping the mind from thinking about other things. And there's no room for it to think about other things when it's thinking about cat over and over again. So it's a very coarse or rough sort of way to develop concentration in young children. And it's worked quite well, because then you move on from a cat to a dog, And then I like to move on to the parents, have them focus on their father and their mother one at a time, which kind of gives them a good feeling and allows them to work out any difficulties or problems they might have with their parents. And it's something that kids generally catch on to pretty quickly. Then focusing on the Buddha, and then eventually focusing on reality, having them focus on their own bodies and their minds and their emotions and so on. It's worked quite well. They were from the experiments I've conducted with children, they've been quite happy and benefited quite a bit from it. So these are the first 10. Going on, then we have what are called the 10 kinds of foulness, and this is something that was particularly fashionable in India, the idea of meditating on a corpse, because India is famous for their treatment of dead people, throwing them into the river or just leaving them in a field, wrapped in a cloth or so on. The idea of charnel grounds, where in old days they would just leave dead bodies in a field or in a pit or so on. And so it was one of the pastimes for monks when they got bored, and there were no TVs in that time, so monks didn't have anything to do in their kutis, so they would go out to the graveyards and watch the dead corpses. And no, I'm just being facetious. It's a wonderful meditation technique, for what it's worth. And what it's wonderful for is for people who have great lust and attachment to the body. Now, lust and attachment for the body, of course, scientifically is a pretty silly and uningenious sort of thing to have. I mean, there's no reason why our body should be considered beautiful or ugly in any way, and yet we have this incredible infatuation with the body and obsession with our own bodies as either beautiful or ugly. And so we try to do our best to make our bodies appear in a certain way that we think of as beautiful. And there's nothing intrinsic about what we see as beautiful. When we find this size and shape and color and texture to be beautiful, what we're actually looking at is something that is, if anything, full of unpleasant and unenticing materials. If you look at the human body as being full of blood and fluids and bones and sinews and skin and so on, then it really, if anything, it's just something that is terribly revolting towards us, and we have this illusion of beauty which we cultivate and attach to and develop in our minds. So going to the charnel ground was a really great thing to do. You could look and you could see, oh, that's what we're really like, and that's what we're all going to be going towards, and kind of getting the other side of the picture so that we can do away with this silly obsession and illusion, misunderstanding of the body as being something somehow wonderful and beautiful, when in fact it's just something natural and very neutral. There's nothing either good or bad about the body. So this type of meditation would be very useful for people who specifically had great extreme states of lust, or people who are having difficulty staying celibate, for instance. So it was a kind of it's the first thing a monk learns in my tradition when they ordain. They're taught the five foul parts of the body. It's not exactly this meditation, but it's a related meditation. This meditation talks about focusing on corpses, but there's another meditation which focuses on the parts of the body, focusing on the hair of the head, the hair of the body, the nails, the teeth, the flesh, the bones, the skin, the skin, the bones, the sinews, all the various organs, and blood and pus and tears and sweat and so on. And you go through this back and forth. And we would use the Pali words. We say when we first ordain, we have to memorize this mantra, and it's a mantra for focusing on the parts of your body, to let you see that there's really nothing wonderful or beautiful about them, and doing away with lust, which is of course quite an important topic for a celibate monk. And we say to ourselves, kesa loma nakha tanta tacho, and then backwards, tacho nakha tanta loma kesa. and forwards and backwards and up and down. And we can go through all the 32 parts. So this is a meditation which you could say is fairly specific. Some people might not have that much use for it, but other people might find it quite useful, for what it's worth. I mean, again, this isn't going to make you enlightened necessarily unless you make it a basis for insight and focusing on the ultimate realities of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. But it's something which can do away with your misunderstandings. This is something that's used even today. I got some pictures in the mail from a German monk. I didn't ask for them. He just sent me a whole bunch of photos of, I guess he was sending them out to a bunch of people, photos of police officers, I think, going into the morgue and watching somebody cut up a dead body. And so we get to see all the parts. We get to see the body when it's dead, and then with its head chopped off, and then with the brain out, and someone holding the brain in their hand, and then opening up the stomach and seeing all the various intestines and so on. And I mean, you can feel it as you watch. It really opens your mind. I have another friend who said he actually went into the morgue and put on some gloves and actually got to hold a kidney or something in his hand, and he was able to see exactly what's inside the human body. And he said it was quite revealing or eye-opening for him. The idea is not to inculcate in us some kind of hatred or disgust for the body. It's to allow us to see what it is that we really are in the physical sense. So this is a fairly useful meditation as well. And there's 10 kinds just based on 10 different kinds of corpses. It's not really worth enumerating them, but in the text they give 10 of them. Then there's the 10 recollections, and these are probably the most fun to talk about. I won't have enough time to do them justice at all, but I can give you sort of an idea of the kind of things that we would recollect. And this is the word, recollect here means sati. This is another translation of the word sati, which is generally translated as mindfulness. So we talk about mindfulness of the Buddha, and people who focus on the Buddha as their meditation. Have you ever heard of these in Thailand? They have this meditation where they just say Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. Or if you've heard it the way they say it, it's Putto, Putto, which simply means Buddho, Buddho, Buddha, the Buddha. And they focus on it because of the wonderful nature of the Lord Buddha, and when you've studied about who the Buddha is and learned something about his story, it's something that gives you great pleasure and great peace and great happiness. It's something which calms the mind down because of the wonderful nature of the Buddha. So it is a really useful meditation, more useful for people who are culturally Buddhist or who have at least some knowledge of who the Buddha was, because it has real meaning for you when you recite this name. Even in the Buddha's time, they say, when people heard that a Buddha had arose, it was such a powerful word. Just hearing this word Buddha, it means one who knows, one who is awake. It was like a legend at the time. When they heard that a Buddha, one who really and truly knows the truth, arose, they would just get this great state of rapture that would flow through their bodies just by hearing the word and by appreciating and the excitement that finally someone who was enlightened had come into the world. Then we have recollection of the Dhamma, so the Buddha's teaching. When you focus on the qualities of the Dhamma as being subject to introspection and inspection, as leading to results in the here and now, when you just focus on these qualities of the Dhamma or focus on the Buddha's teaching, thinking about it, it's something that brings peace to you. When you say to yourself, Dhammo, Dhammo, this isn't nearly as widely used, but it's something that you could very well use as a meditation, and it's included in here. Focusing on the Sangha, this means focusing on the followers of the Lord Buddha, Sariputta, Moggallana, or even just focusing on the monastic community in a lay tradition in Thailand, for instance. Just thinking about the monks or going to see the monks is something that would bring peace and happiness because of their faith and their good relationship with the monks, with the monastic community. Then we have some other ones that are quite interesting, is recollection of virtue. For someone who is virtuous, who has kept moral precepts, simply thinking about one's own morality, sometimes sitting in meditation, this is apparently a meditation that people would undertake, people who had never killed or stole or cheated or lied, people who kept these things pure, could simply by reflecting on their purity of morality, gain great states of concentration and peace. Their minds become focused. The mantra which they use is Silang me parisuthang, my morality is pure. Silang me parisuthang, silang me parisuthang, my morality is pure. By focusing on this, this is sort of an indication of the power of moral precepts, and it hints at the idea of how karma really works on a fundamental level. What we're talking about is the effect that it has on the mind. A person who doesn't keep moral precepts is much more liable to states of fear, states of worry, states of guilt, and so their mind is never fixed or focused. Someone who really does have pure morality, I remember when I first started meditating, I first started keeping the precepts, I would keep precepts of celibacy, actually. I was really keen on it, even not as a monk. I was really keen to get started on the path and really make a dent in some of the mental defilements. And so I kept these precepts of celibacy, and I would take them every week. I would repeat my vows every week on the lunar holiday. And I had this tape that I had downloaded, I had recorded from the internet. This was way back when, you know, CDs weren't even yet that big of a thing. We were still using tapes. And listening to these eight precepts or eight rules, and it was just wonderful to hear and to know that now I was no longer killing, now I was no longer stealing, and just the freedom that I was giving by my precepts, by my rules, that no longer would beings have to fear from me, no longer would beings have to feel suffering because of my actions, no longer would... It was like giving protection to the whole universe simply by my abstaining. It was a wonderful feeling, something that one can only find through the practice of morality. Then we have recollection of generosity. So something that goes hand in hand with virtue being abstention from unwholesome deeds, is generosity, which is the taking up of wholesome deeds, helping other people, giving things which are useful to them. Anyone who's ever given charity from the heart to someone who can really use it knows how wonderful this feels. I have a bunch of stories here, but I'll try to go quickly. The one story that I always remember is of this friend of mine when I was living in Canada before I was at all interested in Buddhism, and we went walking, and she found this man, this homeless man sitting on the street, and she gave him a hamburger. And then she said to me, you know, I don't give to other people because for their benefit. I do it because I'm selfish. And she said, because when I give to other people, it makes me feel happy. I don't have any interest in the other person. When I do it, it makes me feel happy, and that's why I do it. She said, I'm selfish. At the time, she had no clue about Buddhism. I had no clue about Buddhism. It wasn't a Buddhist thing to say, but it was very Buddhist. It's a very wonderful thing, because in Buddhism, we don't call anything wholesome or unwholesome unless it brings good results or bad results. And the benefit that we bring to someone else is felt a hundredfold by our own minds. So simply by reflecting on our generosity, it's a wonderful thing. It's something which really gives us peace of mind. When you're a generous person, when you're giving and helping other people, it can be through even teaching or spreading the teaching, giving. In Buddhist countries, it's often very popular to distribute books or tapes or CDs on the Buddha's teaching, donating sets of the Buddhist scriptures or so on, because this is considered to be a great gift, something which will make you very happy and be able to find peace of mind because of your good deeds. Someone who doesn't give and isn't generous and doesn't do good deeds will often have this sort of feeling of stinginess or miserliness, or will not feel comfortable with themselves, feel like they are always, you know, they'll always be thinking about where they can get good things, and they're not able to give up their desires, their needs for this or that wonderful thing. The next one is recollection of angels. And this is apparently a very potent meditation subject. It probably goes hand in hand only with a tradition which discusses and has some understanding about angels, because most of us never have a chance to see them. But when you learn something about angels and about heaven, it can be a very powerful meditation. If you ever look at the Christian tradition, how powerful it is for them to focus on celestial beings from Jesus on down through angels or saints or so on, focusing on the deceased saints, focusing on the qualities that make one an angel, or focusing on the qualities of those beings who are much purer and wiser and sort of high-minded than we are. If you know anything about how they became angels, and we have all these wonderful stories about how people became angels just by telling the truth, or by being helpful, or being a good citizen, or a good leader, or so on. All of these noble qualities which led people to be born in heaven. Then we have mindfulness or recollection of death, which is a very core Buddhist meditation, something which no matter what meditation we're practicing, we all try our best to incorporate this into our daily lives. And I don't practice mindfulness of death as a meditation, but it's something which is very much a part of my life, to always be thinking about and understanding and not being negligent, not thinking somehow that I can do whatever I want, waste all my time, and it's just going to last forever, that there is an end and my time does run out. And we don't know when that end is or when the time is going to run out. So keeping this in mind and making it a part of our daily routine, sometimes just thinking or knowing that we're going to have to die, and reprimanding ourselves for being negligent and wasting our days and months and years of our life when we don't know how many more we're going to have. But people would actually use this as a meditation. Atuwang me jiwitang, they say life is uncertain. Tuwang maranang, death is certain. At the end of my life, I will have to die. I can't remember the Pali words, I don't use it that often. Tuwang maranang jiwitang me aniatang, my life is unstable. Maranang niatang, death is stable, death is sure, because at the end of life, life has death as its end, and so on. You know, going over these recollections, it's kind of a mantra or a chanting that they do, focusing on the idea of death. And it can be something which, it takes away any interest you have in outside phenomena, and your mind can become very focused as a result. You know, why would you go chasing after external pleasures or so on? You know that they're, in the end, meaningless. As my math teacher used to say, we're worm food. This is, in the end, we get to take nothing with us except for our minds, our state of mind. And so it allows the mind to focus and to calm down. The next one is mindfulness occupied with the body, and I believe this has to do with these parts of the body that I was talking about. When you're focusing on the various pieces of the body, this is mindfulness of the body. We're not yet talking about the in an ultimate sense. So when we talk about the hair on the head, we're still talking about a concept. In reality, hair on the head is simply a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a feeling, or a thought. It's not an ultimate reality. So when we focus on hair of the head, it's useful because it allows us to see that this wonderful hair on her head is actually, you know, kind of greasy and smelly and just sort of stuck there like grass growing out of the earth. And looking at all the various qualities of the hair on her head kind of allows us to see that it's, you know, all of this work and effort we put into making it quote-unquote beautiful is really quite silly. The next one, mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing, of course, is the sort of staple Buddhist meditation which we see across the board. No matter what tradition, everyone's always talking about this basic practice of focusing on the breath. As a conceptual thing, breath, we're focusing specifically on the breath going in, going out. In an ultimate sense, there is no breath going in or going out. So this is placed in this category under the meditation on a concept. In reality, all we have is sensations. When the quote-unquote breath goes into the body, there's actually only a sensation at the various parts of the body. There's a sensation at the nose that arises and ceases. There's a cessation in the sensation in the chest. There's a sensation in the stomach. And these are the realities. So when we're focusing on the breath, many people will use as their mantra in, out, or counting in one, out one, in two, out two, in three, or even just the numbers alone, one, two, three, four, counting the breath up to 10, up to 100, and then back down to one, down to zero, and up and down. It's just a mind training, and all of these things, you could explain them in this way as well, that it doesn't really matter what the word or what the object, what you're doing is training your mind. It's like weightlifting. Someone, they hear about this counting your breath and they say, what a pointless exercise. And it's the same as going into a weightlifting room and looking at someone lifting weights and saying, boy, what a pointless exercise. And we all know it's not pointless, that actually some great benefit comes from developing the body, and that is bodily strength. Well, the same goes with developing the mind. It should be obvious, and it's really sad that it isn't. That walking back and forth, people say, what are you doing walking back and forth? It would be the same as saying, you know, what are you doing exercising the body? We're exercising the mind. We're having the mind become stronger and more focused and more supple and more pliant, because we're going to use it for all sorts of interesting things. And then the last one is recollection of peace, focusing on, in this case, focusing on cessation, the cessation of suffering. And this is something which it's not widely used, and I think it's a fairly specific meditation. I'm not going to go into great detail, but you know, focusing on the idea of peace and how great it is to feel, to have peace, and seeking out peace is a way of seeing the difference between the things which we thought were going to bring us happiness and that which actually does, which is peace. Moving on, we have the four divine abidings. These are called Brahma Vihara, and these are very well known in Buddhist circles, especially the first two. Actually, I think they're all, three of them at least, are very well known. The first one is Metta, or I can't remember the exact Sanskrit. Metta means loving kindness, so we all hear about Metta meditation, meditation on love, or meditation on friendliness. And then we have meditation on compassion, karuna, which we translate as being compassion, meditating on sort of as a wish, may all beings be free from suffering. Love is the idea, may all beings be happy. Compassion is the idea, may all beings, the wish, may all beings be free from suffering. So one is positive, one is negative. They actually are quite similar otherwise. The idea is that may beings be free from suffering, may beings be truly happy. May all beings develop themselves, and may they be free from whatever suffering that comes from them. The third one is called mudita, which is the meditation on joy. And here specifically, joy for other people's good deeds. And this can be a wonderful relieving sort of meditation. Instead of being jealous of other people and their good deeds, feeling glad and happy when you see other people get good things, not being sad that you didn't get it or feeling unworthy yourself, really feeling happy for someone, even if they might be miles and miles ahead of you or above you, just feeling happy for them for being so great and having such good qualities and good deeds. When we see people do other good deeds that even if we think we could never do, just being happy for them that they can do it. Or even simple things that might not make much difference, but we can see that they came from the heart and someone was really trying. So we feel happy for them that they were able to do that. This is a meditation. It's something which calms the mind down. And the fourth one is equanimity. These four are the divine abidings. The meaning is it's dwelling with God. This is the path to God. So when people talk about how to get to God, these four are considered in Buddhism to be the path to God. When you practice these, if you practice them to their fulfillment, and even any one of them, when you die, you go to become one with Brahma. This is the path to the Brahma world, as the Lord Buddha taught it. Then we have the four immaterial states. I think I'm going to skip over these because I would like to get a little bit, at least talk briefly about insight meditation. The four immaterial states are based on other meditations. Maybe I'll have to give another talk about them because I don't have time now. These are meditations based on, not on a physical concept, on a mental concept. So the idea of infinity or the idea of nothingness. And they're very specific, and their method of development requires a little bit of explanation based on the earlier meditations of like the white color or so on. Then the last two is the perception of the foulness of food. And this is a fun one for monastics. When you go on alms round and you come back, sitting down and looking at your food all mixed up together in the bowl, and putting your hand and squishing it all up and getting it all over your hand, and then taking your hand up and placing it in your mouth, and really coming to understand and get rid of this silly attachment that we have for certain types of tastes and foods, thinking that somehow this is going to bring us happiness. I remember I was talking to my students. One of my students said, "You know, I'm just getting bored of eating." It was like, I never thought this would come. It's like, I got to eat again. It's like this incredible freedom, you know, not having to obsess and chase after tastes. She was like totally, you know, just fed up with having to eat, and it became almost a chore, which it really is. I mean, just thinking about it, I mean, what is the one addiction that we'll never be able to do away with? The one thing that we'll never be able to be free from, and this is the disease of hunger and thirst, the need to continuously replenish these things. And it's become a real problem for a great many of people. This is why there's so much disease in the world. A lot of it can simply be attributed to food and our inability to understand food simply for what it is. So this is a good one for people who are infatuated with eating or obsessed with their eating habits. Just seeing it for what it is as something that is fairly repulsive. When it goes in, it's not doesn't look the greatest. When it comes out, it certainly doesn't look anything near as good as when it went in. And all of the fruit that comes from it in the various parts of the body is not a pleasant thing either. And the last one is the separation of the physical into elements. And this is a good segue into the other type of meditation, which I'm talking about, meditation on ultimate reality. In a conceptual sense, separating the body into the elements is separating the various parts of the body into those which have the earth element in the sense of being hard, like our teeth or our bones, those which are watery, like our blood and sweat and tears, those which are pressurized or are have pressure in them, like the wind in the stomach or the muscles which have a certain pressure. And the fire element is the heat which comes from food and so on. But this is the only one of all of these meditations which they accept in this tradition to be used as a basis for the development of insight meditation, because it can also be used to look at ultimate reality, that in an ultimate sense these things do appear in the experience. When we in general, in the experience of the physical, when we touch something, when we're sitting and we touch the ground or we touch the floor or we touch the chair, there's a sensation of hardness or softness, heat or cold. In this room, it's either hot or cold, and there's these sensations of heat coming from food and so on. This is a real experience that we're having, whatever we want to call it or say that it is. That is a real part of reality, and this is where insight meditation starts. In the practice of insight meditation, we always take the physical as the basis of meditation. Some people might find this odd when really what we're trying to focus on is the mind. But the idea in the texts, the explanation in the texts, is that, yes, ideally we want to be looking at the mind, but it's much easier said than done. You can't just close your eyes and say, where's my mind, and go after it and come to understand it and take it as an object is quite difficult. It's not clear to the beginner meditator. The only thing that becomes clear to a beginner meditator is the physical, in general, except in extreme cases. When you're in great pain, then you can focus on the emotion of sadness or fear or so on. But on a general level, in the beginning of meditation, the only thing that becomes clear is the physical. Generally with the breath, when you're sitting in meditation, you feel the chest rising and falling, the stomach rising and falling, you feel the heat and the cold at the nose, you feel the pressure touching the floor and so on. And so we take these as our basic object of meditation. And as a result of taking the physical as an object, what happens, of course, is that the mind has to go with it. When we say we're focusing on the physical, what's happening is the mind is going out to the physical, and there's an interaction between the two. So when we focus on, say, the stomach rising and falling, which is in what I always teach, you just focus on the stomach rising. It's really a silly thing to do. I mean, what do you care what the stomach is like? But it's amazing that as you do, you learn so much about your mind. Firstly, how our mind likes to control absolutely everything. We have to make everything perfect. And so when we watch the stomach rising and falling, it's not good the way it is. We have to make it something better. And we do all these mental gymnastics trying to make it always rise and always fall at the same length and be deep and be in the right place, be smooth, be comfortable. And it just gets worse and worse until we freak out and are not able to sit still anymore. And we realize to ourselves that we're approaching the whole thing from the wrong point of view, and we're approaching life and experience from the wrong direction. We're looking at it wrong. Instead of simply seeing it for what it is, which is what we're trying to do when we say to ourselves rising and falling, it's not to make it rise or make it fall. It's to remind ourselves that this is reality. This is what's happening. It's not me, it's not mine, it's not good, it's not bad. I don't have to force it. I don't have to make it anything other than what it is. We learn a lot simply by focusing on the physical, and as a result then focusing on the mental, liking or disliking, judging, thinking, remembering, recognizing, and all of the pain and pleasure which comes as a result. And this is the basis of insight meditation. I didn't get at all into the benefits that come from these, but in brief, there's a profound difference that comes from these two types of meditation. If you've never practiced the first types of meditation I was talking about, it's quite unlikely that you'll get any profound states of knowledge or vision about magical or mystical or super mundane things like heaven or hell or being able to read people's minds or fly through the air or remember your past lives or so on. This is what can be gained through the devotion to concepts. Because the great thing about a conceptual object is that, as I said, it doesn't change. It's something which you can really and truly focus and gain incredible states of concentration based on. And these can be used for very wonderful and powerful and incredible things. But the benefit of focusing on reality, even though the concentration is not so strong because the objects are always changing and moving and fluctuating, is you get this great understanding and wisdom about how reality works and how your misunderstanding of reality leads you to suffering at all the time, again and again. Our inability to accept things for the way they are and our need to control, our need to force, it's on a whole other level. In fact, it's very easy through the practice of conceptual meditation to get lost and to grasp and to hold on to wrong views, the idea of permanence, the idea of self and soul and ego and me and mine, and it can actually cultivate and support these states, whereas insight meditation focusing on reality cannot do that. It allows us to let go and see clearly. So I think I've talked quite enough. I could go on for hours some of these days. So I'll just stop there, and if you have any questions, I'll leave something for next week. Thank you all for coming.